Hi, I'm Becky Sims, and welcome to Behind the Future, the podcast from Aspiration Digital. We're here to unlock digital careers, one conversation at a time. On each episode, I'll be joined by a student co-host. We'll be interviewing amazing people from across the industry to learn about how they got started in their career and what it is that they do. Let's dive in to find out the secrets to their success. Whoa, that was something, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was amazing.
Oh, Daryl is just, I mean, I could pick his brain all day long, and I do sometimes. So What was most impactful for you?
Honestly, when he was talking about visualization, how you can visualize things, and talking about how you can learn a lot from people's body language, I really like that.
So yeah, it's really good, isn't it? We went into so many places. There's some tips for revision, which will be interesting, won't it? And I think, are you going to test out what he suggested?
100%. Yeah, it was really good.
Yeah. Oh, I think it's time to let our audience dive in. Honestly, you're in for a treat. We'll let you dive into the episode now.
Hi, I'm Daryl, and I'm taking you behind the future.
Welcome to another episode of Behind the Future. I am really excited today. We have Elliot joining me. Elliot, tell us a little bit about you.
I'm in year 12. I'm at MGGS and I'm studying media, business and product design.
Amazing. I feel like maths as well, you were saying.
Yeah, I do core maths as well.
Very good. Very good. I like it. And we are very lucky to be interviewing the amazing Daryl Scott today. Daryl, tell us a little bit about yourself.
I'm Daryl Scott. And I am a coach primarily, but I'm an author and a consultant, and I've owned several digital agencies over the years.
Wow, there's a lot to find out about there. So let's dive straight in. First question.
So considering you're a coach, what problems do you encounter when coaching people?
Oh, wow. That's a really good question. So if you go off and learn coaching, often they'll give you coaching models, things like the GROW model is a really popular one where you start with your goal and work through certain challenges or whatever. But when you get out there in the reality as a coach, what you find is that the start point isn't very clear. People rarely come in and say, right, here's my goal, or here's my challenge, or here's exactly what it is in a really neat, tidy, packaged way. They don't know what the goal is, or they don't really know what's getting in their way. So the first stage, and possibly the most important one in coaching someone, is getting to the bottom of what's really the challenge or what they really need help with.
And how do you go about doing that? All your secrets are going to come out now.
You start talking.
Yeah.
You say, hello, how are you? And you start talking, and the real stuff emerges in listening to what people are saying, but also what they're not saying. So you watch for body language and, where there's tension. You look for the words that have got extra emphasis. You look for the double negatives and the things where they're slightly contradicting themselves. And when you hear those kind of things, that's the door that you push on. You just say, can you tell me more about that? And very quickly, you'll arrive at a place of self-awareness or kind of an awareness of what it is that they really need to address.
Yeah, a lot of people kind of like keep things to themselves, and it's really hard to tell like what they actually mean when they're saying things.
So, yeah. There's that first level of openness, like that withholding, as they would call it in FIRO theory, and what's really interesting about that, and it's one of those things that I'd encourage people listening to consider. Sometimes I run workshops, and we set up this exercise where we go around in small sort of trusted groups, and you ask the question, what do you pretend? And you say to the person, what do you pretend? And they tell you, and then they'll turn to the next person and say, what do you pretend? And et cetera. And as you go round and round, it gets more and more exposing. People become more and more comfortable, more and more safe, and then they become more and more open about what it is that they're holding in or pretending or styling out. And then the most interesting thing happens, because they'll say this thing. They'll say this thing that they've been holding on to that they're not happy saying out loud. And they'll push up against it. And there's almost this barrier that they have to leap through. And then they say, well, I pretend blah, blah, blah. And the most extraordinary thing happens, because no one really reacts. And some people say, yeah, me too. And suddenly all of the power disappears from that thing that they've been hanging on to so tightly, because frankly, we're all humans, and we all have varieties of the same kind of insecurities. And they, you know, over the years and with time, they get allayed by experience. You know, your insecurities just die down and become less significant or less intrusive. But obviously, when you're starting out in the world and you're still trying to orient yourself, you know, with the environment that you're in and who am I in this world and am I good enough at this, that and the other and who are my friends and who aren't and all of those kind of things that are quite confusing, that's when we might hold back a little bit. But the advice I give people is experiment with being more open than you would normally be. I mean, don't, you know, flood people with absolutely everything, you know, too much information. But when you find yourself pushing up against that thing where you might not feel comfortable saying it, now and then just say it and see what happens, because you'll be amazed at the consequence.
Do you think, have you noticed through your coaching career how much of an impact social media is having on people? Because I guess we all have these views of this people that people show up in the world on social media, which tends to be just all the good stuff, doesn't it? People showing off the amazing things they've achieved and all the wondrous stuff. And you don't necessarily see the behind the scenes of all the tough things that happen. And actually, it's not like that every day. Is that causing people to be a bit more comparing themselves and thinking they're not enough or thinking they haven't achieved what they wanted? Are you spotting that?
Yeah, I think it amplifies the natural human tendency to compare ourselves unfavorably.
Yeah.
So what I mean by that is, you know, when people make comparisons about themselves, if they're this enough or that enough, you know, they never compare themselves against the absolutely average Joe. You know, they never compare themselves against the 50% benchmark. They always compare themselves against someone who's doing rather well or is very visibly good or, you know, something they might aspire to. And then, of course, they always come off unfavorably in that comparison. Now, you know, we all, you know, but just because, you know, the more boring stuff of our life is not worth posting, we all tend to post the good stuff. And then, of course, the consequence of that is you only see people's good stuff, and that can lead you to potentially have a distorted view of what their life's really like, think that it's more glamorous, more interesting than it is, think that they've got more good stuff going on than you have. You know, it's a really natural human tendency that social media, unfortunately, amplifies. But it's not like social media is causing this problem. It's just amplifying a natural human tendency.
Yeah.
Sorry,
I was going to say, and I guess it ties back to the fact that we're ambitious because we want to compare ourselves with the person that's doing more interesting stuff or has done more because we want to be that person because we want to do more. So actually, in some ways, it's partly a good thing because we kind of want more for ourselves as well. Yeah,
really, really good awareness. So a lot of people sometimes, and they say they've got imposter syndrome or that kind of thing, you know, worry about being good enough. And it's an interesting process when you unpick it because I don't know, let's imagine you're 4 years old or something and you're in a playground or you're at school, you're with a parent, and for the first time you get negatively judged. You know, instead of them saying, oh, that's a wonderful blob of paint, you know, they might say it's not very good, or, you know, you might try and read out loud and your classmates laugh, or a teacher may tell you off, or, you know, things happen and they hurt your feelings. And when your feelings get hurt like that, you kind of go inwards and you berate yourself and you say something bad to yourself. But then the most interesting thing happens is you try harder. You know, you dust yourself off and you go again, you know, and you try harder and you grow and you do better. But you, after you've had that hurt feeling experience, you only ever notice the bit that isn't quite good enough.
Yeah.
So then you dust yourself off and you have another go and you grow and you do better, but you only notice what's not good enough. So then you dust yourself off and you have another go and you grow and you only notice, and it continues and continues until one day you've achieved what you never imagined you would. You know, you've grown way beyond your expectations, but you have not noticed it because you've just been paying attention to where it wasn't quite good enough. But then when you see that as a process, it's actually a motivation. It's actually what drives growth, you know, and those words, not good enough, they're not really very accurate. Like, who says, or not good enough for what? They're just nonsense words. They're really just a feeling that you have. But what's interesting is that feeling is what drives us forward. It's what drives that kind of growth. Without it, we wouldn't be, you know, dusting ourselves off and having another go and being more and more ambitious. But then when you get to the point where you've started to notice that you're on track or you've exceeded your expectations, over the course of time, you can begin to let it go. And what's really interesting is then it sort of liberates you to be even more of yourself. Yeah. Mm. So the advice I always give people is to change the voice in your head. So next time you berate yourself and you say not good enough, change it to not good enough for my own aspirations, not good enough for my own self-imposed standards. Or, you know, turn it into like an encouraging voice, like a sports coach going, come on, not good enough. You know, turn it into the motivation that it is, rather than the potentially hurtful self-criticism that it could be.
And also just that word yet at the end. I'm not good enough yet. I'm working on this. I'm growing. I'm working towards it. I don't expect to be 100% yet.
Yeah.
And I'm taking steps forward. I think yet's like a really great word to add to the end of that kind of sentence, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, a lot of times, like, a lot of people just tend to subconsciously like judge themselves and say we're not good enough. Like, even I do this myself sometimes when I want to do better or something. I always look at where are my flaws, stuff like that. So I think, yeah, I kind of agree with what you're saying.
Yeah. And all those negative self-judgments are there to make us better.
Yeah.
You know, we worry about being liked, and that's what makes us be nice people and interact well with others. We worry about being good enough, and that's what drives our growth and our improvement. We worry about, you know, if we're important enough or if we matter, and that's what allows us to find our niche and strive to find our place in the world. So they're all really good, positive drivers, really. It's just that they feel rubbish.
Yeah, they do, don't they, at the time. How did you get into being a coach?
By accident. So I was running an agency, it started before digital happened, really. So it was a below-the-line agency. We used to do brochures and mailers and, you know, websites made of cardboard. and then digital happened, and we kind of jumped on that change and transformation and got better and better at it. But during that period, I had that agency for 10 years, and about 9 years in, a friend of mine had discovered this field called neuro-linguistic programming, which you may have heard of, you know, sort of from, I don't know, Paul McKenna or Darren Brown or one of those type of Tony Robbins. And I had no idea what it was, but I was lucky enough to have the time to rock up on a course for a week. And so I arrived sort of wide-eyed and naive and thinking, why am I even here? And got absolutely bitten by the bug. I loved it. I did an NLP practitioner course and then a master practitioner. And then I went to become a trainer of NLP because I thought that maybe that would be something that would be a nice career, you know, later in life, or something that I could start to invest time in learning. And I went on this course with one of the crazy Californians who invented NLP, this guy called Dr. John Grinder. It's this amazing Obi-Wan Kenobi, James Bond type, you know, used to be a spy, was a professor of linguistics, speaks 11 languages, you know, can ride wild horses bareback, and, you know, just the most amazing character. I was in his 70s when I met him. And he showed a real interest in me and sort of offered to give me some guidance and mentor me. So I sold my business so that I could devote my time to learning as much as possible from this extraordinary character. And I wrote a few books and built a consultancy that supported my passion for learning more about the unconscious mind.
Love that. And so what's NLP for someone that doesn't know?
So NLP stands for neuro-linguistic programming. Although that, I do think that the title's a bit out of date in terms of what it's emerged and turned into, but it's really a way of exploring how you see and hear and feel and think about the world. You know, what's your full experience of the world, and what are the patterns and programs that you have running unconsciously, and how can you revise them? Because there are many, many ways to make all kinds of unconscious changes really, really quickly. It's one of the things that I get saddest about in life is people that think that change is really laborious and slow and mainly driven by cognitive approaches to change. But actually, if you get into the you know, unconscious imagery of the mind and the unconscious physical responses, and you work directly with that, change is really quick and really amazing. So NLP was really a project of initially exploring how certain geniuses did amazing things and trying to codify that and work out what it is that they're doing, because academic people were trying to make sense of their methodology and failing because they were so unusual that you couldn't really theorize it. You know, no one could work out where to start. So NLP was this methodology of spending time with geniuses and assimilating their ability by copying them, like role modeling, like in a really deeply unconsciously connected way. And then going through a very deliberate methodology of working out, well, what is it about these behaviors that's creating these extraordinary results? And then those models, if you like, those descriptions of what it is that geniuses do got packaged up, turned into a series of models. And that's what people tend to learn on an NLP course. They learn these models that have been coded by exploring people's behavior. But NLP in its truest form is actually the ability to role model with incredible precision.
Amazing. So interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. So we know that you've done an apprenticeship before. So how did that help you on like your journey to?
So my apprenticeship was a long time ago. So it was in the 1980s, end of the 1980s. And I was a lithographer, and I did the same apprenticeship as Ridley Scott, the film director. Yeah. And I used to work in a dark room and, you know, with films. Yeah. And back in the old days, if you wanted to create a piece of, you know, printed material, for example, you would design it sort of conceptually, and then you would have it typeset. So and then once it had all been typeset and sort of printed out in all only in black and white, you would then shoot that on a camera. You would photograph this typeset image, which turned it into film. And then you could then use masks and tints and things to create four different films, a cyan one, a magenta one, a yellow one, a black one, and they could be put onto printing plates to make a color image or a. So there was this whole big, very, very skillful, darkroom, labor intensive process to get something from a design and typeset design to a printing plate. And it was a very photographic process. And I did a very, very specialist niche thing, which is where I used to take images like photographs or whatever and separate them out into cyan, magenta, yellow and black so that when you put them back together, it looked like the original. And it was a very difficult thing to learn. And it took 4 years. And my first year, I did nothing. I made the tea and I watched and I watched and I watched and I watched all these really skilled craftsmen doing what they do. Second year, I would do the job, started to do the job under supervision. In year three, I would sort of do it a little bit on my own, and then my results were constantly supervised. And then year four, I had a year of just being on my own, and they were there if I got into trouble, but really had a year of going through it and dealing with every sort of situation that could got thrown at you with someone sort of watchfully looking over you. And it was really, I think for me, a couple of things came from that. One was skill and ability isn't, you can't learn it just by knowing stuff. You know, I think sometimes if that job existed today, there'd just be a 2-week training course and people would get it. They'd know what the job is, but they wouldn't have skill and judgment. You know, they wouldn't have ability. But in those days, we used to sort of, ability was assimilated from a craftsman, you know, and you had to, it's like anything that's really hands-on skillful, it takes a long, long time and a lot of trial and error. So I think that's one thing that's a real driver for me is how do you create experiences to help people learn rather than just telling them stuff? How do you really help them? How do you throw your arms around them and give them the chance to be courageous and explore and learn by trial and error? So that's really important to me. The other thing was, by the time I was 2 years out of my apprenticeship, the Apple Mac got very involved in the world of publishing and media and printing, and this highly, highly skilled job that I'd spent 4 years of my life becoming really, really good at, and it was an incredibly highly paid job as well. It was awfully paid at the beginning. I was virtually paying them to be there, and by the end it was extraordinarily well paid. And within 2 years of finishing my apprenticeship, the role was pretty much redundant. It was disappearing from everywhere. I had been replaced by, you know, you could pop something on a flatbed scanner and the computer would just do it for you. So this craft that I spent all this time learning got completely disrupted. So by the age of 20, the age of 22, I'd learned how severely disruption happens with technology and how just move on to the next thing. You know, just greet it with wide-eyed delight and throw yourself into the next iteration of your journey and not hang on to how things used to be.
And was that your initial reaction or did you go through a bit of pain first?
Well, I was able to sidestep it.
Okay.
Because I was in this industry, and then I got headhunted by a brother-in-law of a client who offered me a job in America, and doing something slightly different. It was a sales role. And I was sort of at that age where I just thought, oh, if I don't do this, I'll regret it forever. You know, there was this sort of offer of a company house and a company car and living in Sarasota in Florida. And it was a year and a half of being on a sort of a J-1 visa, like an exchange. And but I ended up staying there. I ended up there all told for nearly 3 years, going between the UK and US. And so then when I came back to re-enter the industry that I'd been trained in, it had all changed. And I got the chance to take a big deep breath and look at it anew. And in fact, the fact that it had changed and my old discipline didn't exist anymore was the very thing that drove me to start my first agency on my parents' dining room table at 24 years old.
Amazing. What was it like up in Styx and moving to a different country to start exploring a role? And
well, it was weird, really, because I didn't think much of it. I mean, I was 22 and I had a suitcase and I didn't know anyone the other side. So I just got on a plane with a suitcase and said, see you later to my friends and family. And I'll be back soon. See ya. And, but I think it was the fact that it was, this kind of very, well provided for cultural exchange program that allowed me to, at 22 years old, be completely, fearless and just jump on an airplane, because it was, you know, it was all wrapped around for me. When I got there, I had a house and a car provided. So, that made it easier to be courageous.
So would you recommend to young people, if they get an opportunity like that, or they've got a course they can go and do that means they have to go somewhere different? Do you think you got a lot from that experience?
Definitely. It was formative. You know, and even to this day, a lot of the ways I behave in business are very American. Like American business behaviors were, it was a formative age for me. So they really stuck. But I think, anything that allows you to change context broadens your mind, because, you know, you get to challenge some really deep rooted assumptions. You get to see that things can be fundamentally different. And you know, not only do you see things are better elsewhere sometimes, but even more importantly, you come to really appreciate, you know, where you're from a lot of the time, because you realize that it's very easy when you're in the thick of it to moan about the negatives. But when you go somewhere else, you suddenly think, oh, hang on a minute. Maybe not so bad after all.
I didn't know how good I had it already. Interesting.
Just a quick note from me. We'd love you to hit the subscribe button. This helps us more than you might realize when it comes to growing this podcast, ensuring we can bring you the best guests possible. Thank you. Back to the episode.
Elliot, any other questions?
As we know, like this, as years go on, like technology is growing and, you know, jobs aren't as more common as they are now. So do you have any advice you'd tell maybe your younger self back in the day, to direct yourself more?
So what would I give? I think one of the challenges with being young is we always think we're older than we are.
Yeah.
So we put more pressure on ourselves to be somewhere already when we've actually still got all the time in the world. I remember when I moved back from America, before I'd started my business, I landed back from America. I stayed at my parents' house. I had plenty of cash. My house was rented. I bought my first house at 20 years old because this apprenticeship job I described earlier was so highly skilled and lucrative. And that was rented out. So I was in this amazingly flexible position. I had money in my pocket. And my friend Paul phoned, who was living in Hong Kong. And this was the middle of the 90s. And he said, just get on a plane. You can stay at my place. You'll have a job by tomorrow. You know, there's no visas or passport issues. It was still, you know, part of the United Kingdom at the time. You know, we've only got 4 years until it goes back to being China, essentially. So, jump on a plane. It's a party. It's an amazing time out here. It was the last hurrah of the colonial Hong Kong, if you like. And I said, well, you know, I think I need to start to be sensible and think about my career. And I think I need to stay here and get a job. And all of these things in my mid-20s, where I now look at my younger self and think, what were you doing? You know, just get on the plane. So I think there's that. I think we sometimes put a lot of pressure onto ourselves to have achieved X by however many years old and to achieve Y by however many years old. But careers aren't linear and life isn't linear. And you're far better off just following your curiosity or your passion or leaning into your specialties and what you're good at and connecting with the right tribes who are your kind of people. And you're better off paying attention to that stuff than kind of almost like the linear ladder of career and life progression, because life's much more swirling and unpredictable than that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not a tick list to be going, I've got to do this, this, this. It's, yeah, follow your heart. So you didn't get on the plane. You didn't get to Hong Kong.
No, I stayed in the UK and started an agency, which was also an amazing adventure. And, you know, I started it from nothing. And 3 years later, we're turning over 1 million and had a nice team of really, really close friends. And it's still the best team I've ever worked in my whole career. We didn't realize what we had at the time, but we were so glued together. There were 11 of us and we were thick as thieves. And it was a wonderful, wonderful time.
How do you go about starting a business?
It's a huge question, just a little question.
Well, the
reason for the delay is it depends.
It depends, yeah. You know, how did you go about it? Like, so you're back from America, what next is in your mind?
Yes. So, I think there's two things. One is every business starts with a sale. Yeah. So don't worry about crafting your website and getting your letterhead and you know, defining your values, you know, before you've got any kind of traction or anyone that wants to work with you for something. So first thing is, you know, what have you got? What can you bring and that people might want or need? And, you know, do you have access to people who could potentially give you money for that? So that's the first question. It's really functional nuts and bolts. What can you do? What do people need? Have you got access to them? Yeah, really, really simple. And then at the time I came back, I didn't have any, didn't have much money behind me. I didn't really have any, you know, the industry had transformed. I didn't have that much skill really even, but I noticed that, as technology was changing and a lot of the old disciplines of, the print industry, which was, I mean, it was so artisan, you know, there were just never mistakes. Everything was done so impeccably. But as the industry had changed and we were in this sort of new phase of technology, people were making horrendous mistakes and costing themselves a fortune all of the time because they didn't know how to buy print or they didn't know how to go from the computerized idea of what they were trying to achieve to whether that actually works on paper. So there became this real opportunity to get in between that buying process of the design and whatever they're creating and the cost of production and make sure that that doesn't fail. So it's this window of time and I thought, wow, I can be that person. I can be that person that saves you a fortune by eliminating your errors. So I did that and I started this little business called The Colour Network, it was called. And it lasted for a few months because I met a really, really talented designer and we decided to go into business together. And then we started this agency, True Colours, which I had for 10 years and sold to a company in Basingstoke called The Escape. Mm.
Oh, I know of The Escape. I didn't know that's who
they bought
who
my bought first her. Agency, yeah.
There you go. It's a small world. And I suppose that's an interesting point, isn't it? Once you get into a sector and so like in the digital and the creative sector, it is quite small, isn't it? So has that network played a big part in your ability to grow the business and where you are today?
it's a double-edged sword because on one hand, I find the digital world to be excitable and open and connected and so many events and there's so many fantastic people who are open to new ideas and who talk to each other and share thinking. So from that point of view, it's just brilliant. So it's brilliant to be a coach and have an industry where you're quite well known and you're quite well networked and there's access to all these people. The other side of the coin is agencies in general do not invest in their own sharpening of the saw, their learning and development. I mean, you can meet an agency owner who's 32 years old who has never done a training course. Yeah. You know, they've lived on their wits and they've never They've never had a coach. They've never, so it's not a particularly learning and development savvy industry. You know, people make do. They hack it, and, you know, which is testament to their ability to pay attention to what's needed and just, you know, be resourceful. But also, you know, sometimes it's easier to sell what I do to other industries that are a bit more professionalized.
Mm.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, we definitely are winging it in our sector a little bit, aren't we? So, which is fun, but also, yeah. Do you, from a coaching perspective, obviously it tends to be a lot of business owners might get to a point where they go, oh, I could do with a coach, I could do with the help with the next stage. But if you could paint the picture of the perfect world, when should someone have a coach? What's the point that they should start to interact with someone to help challenge and drive them?
All the time. Or a mentor, coach or mentor. And I think, you know, you don't need to see them much. You know, some people might have a mentor and they may have two coffees with them a year, or some people may have a coach and they may see them once a quarter, or, but no one ever really made it big without a mentor. And I think doing myself out of business, but I think mentoring is even more important than coaching sometimes, especially when you're young. You know, you don't just need someone to help you, you know, unfold your abilities. Sometimes you need someone who's been there, bought the t-shirt, to just give you a little bit of a guide, because there are a lot of things that older people can't help you with, because we're in a changing world and younger people are faster and more adapted and more immersed in it. But there are a lot of absolutely immutable truths that older people can accelerate you and help you with, things that you can learn it yourself, but it's going to take you one or two decades, or you can get there much, much quicker if you hear the stories of someone older. And those stories aren't about like specific technology. They're about people. They're about people, commerce, entrepreneurship, community, you know, what it is to have a career in the world.
Yeah. The relationship side is so important, isn't it? And
yeah,
building that up throughout your career and learning how to read people. And I guess the psychology side of what you've done has really amplified that for you and helped you, because you've got such a good way of understanding people that most normal people don't get to do.
Yeah, it does. It allows me to go deeper. It allows me to see things quicker. And with all this stuff, coaching and everything, it's like the dentist, you know. You know you should go for your checkup and you don't. But when you've got a toothache, you can't get there quickly enough. And it can be like that when you're a consultant and a coach sometimes, where it's almost annoying when people call you, and it's great that they call you and they trust you to help them with their challenges or whatever. But you do think, why didn't you call me 6 months ago when this was, you know, when you were first aware of it? You know, why are we now at this sort of emergency service stage?
Yeah, the sirens are going and it's like, oh, we could have stopped the sirens from going.
Yeah.
Do you have a coach yourself?
Always.
Always.
Yeah, I'm required to. So I work as a coach and a therapist, strangely. So I have to have a coach and a therapist. And because it's a requirement, and a supervisor technically as well, although I don't always have one of them, but I often do. But because it's a requirement, I see that as I've got to do it anyway, so I may as well shop about a bit and learn as many different approaches.
Yeah. So get the most from it yourself.
Yeah. So I'll go and find, you know, people who have whose expertise comes from fields that I'm not as familiar with, so I can soak that up as well, you know. So I could, it's almost like a kid in a candy shop. You know, I want to go around and I want to try all of the sweets.
Yeah.
Because I've got to do it anyway, so I may as well. You know, as well as it helping me on a daily basis, it could be a learning exercise as well.
So do you sit in a different seat in that sense when you're being coached? Of partly you're letting them coach you, but are you also dissecting, oh, I like what they did there. That's interesting. How did they get me there? Like, oh, I shouldn't even. But yeah, is there a different intentionality about the sessions?
Yeah. I wasn't very good at it when I first started being coached or therapist or whatever, because I'd just be sitting there thinking, oh, no, you missed. No, that's the wrong question. Oh, no. So, you know, I'd be critiquing them almost, you know, and that was a real silliness. I don't know why I'd used to do that. So, but then I just thought, well, I'll sit back, I'll go with the flow, and then I sit for a while and reflect on it afterwards, and that's where I'll unpick, I see what they did. oh, now I know why they asked me that. And so you kind of retrospectively reflect on the experience and the consequence of the experience, and that's what can help you understand it. And that stops it getting in the way. And I mean, I think a lot of the time, and this is, you know, everything from if we're having to do a presentation or any kind of interaction where we need to be here now, the biggest challenge is, you know, trying to still be doing our homework when we're actually in the process, or trying to think of what's going to happen afterwards while we're still during.
Yeah.
So when our mind goes to preparation or consequence afterwards, whilst we're still in the moment, we're not here. We're not soaking as much up. So it's almost like do your preparation, be in the moment, and then reflect on it and make sense of it afterwards.
Yeah.
And the more you can clearly almost partition those ways of thinking, the more you'll get from the experience.
Yeah. It's different intentionalities, isn't it? I think we talked about it ahead of doing the podcast. Like, you can just listen to a podcast and enjoy it. But if you know you're about to go and be an interviewer on a podcast, you can listen to a podcast with a whole different lens where you're like, oh, I see what they did there. Oh, I like what they did there. And actually, you can learn so much from it, even though it's the exact same podcast, but you've just tuned your brain to look at it slightly differently to what everyone else is doing.
Yeah. And I must admit, one of the things that I'm really pleased to see at the moment, or that I'm really enjoying, is the, mainly because of podcasts, but the return to longer form communication.
Yeah.
Because it everything had become for a while so bullet pointed and soundbited and out of context. And it was just like, you know, people had such polarized opinions and such, you know, overly confident, rigid judgments on everything. And obviously, when you sit down and listen to someone for an hour and a half, you get a very, very different experience and a very, very different picture than if you listen to a 7-second soundbite that's been presented to you under a particular narrative, you know. So I'm loving that, you know, even like really prominent public figures that people have opinions about, they then get to listen to them for an hour and a half, and they can have a potentially a broader or a more insightful opinion rather than just the soundbite or just the judgment, you know.
So true, so true.
Are Duolingo, Nike and McDonald's some of your favorite brands? For all the latest marketing and brand news, follow The Drum Mag on Instagram.
Obviously, like, I've seen you at Aspiration Digital. How was your experience there? I mean, speaking on stage to a bunch of young people.
Well, I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
I loved it. I think, you know, generations behave differently. So, you know, it's not what I'm used to. You know, I'm used to people a little bit older who behave a certain way. So then you go to somewhere like Aspiration Digital, and as a presenter, sometimes I think you can almost be forgiven that they're not even for thinking they're not listening. You know, it's like, so you get people like slumping in the chairs. They look like they're nodding off. There's the, you know, they're on the phone. There's the odd like conversation between them. And you're like, whoa, you know, what is this? And then you get to the end of your talk and you get the questions and you go, oh my goodness, they're sponges. They were listening to everything,
yeah.
You know, and they're filtering this stuff. And the quality of the questions is so good. So I loved it. I loved it from that point of view. I loved, you know, at the end of each speech, listening to the questions was my favorite bit, because it was a real lens on what the audience was soaking up, you know, and the directions they take their questions in. That's insightful as well. Like, every question has the answer baked in already. You know, if you listen to what someone's really asking, they're also showing you what they're thinking. You know, yeah. every question is a bit of a giveaway as to what someone, because of where they've taken the conversation or because of a proposition baked into the question. So, you know, if I say, how enjoyable has this podcast been, or how stressful has this podcast been? You know, I'm asking you about the podcast, but somewhere in the middle of that is a different presupposition. I'm presupposing it's enjoyable, or I'm presupposing that it's stressful. Or so listening to questions is so insightful, because you can hear what people are thinking underneath the question. And yes, so I was quite inspired by the audiences, the young people. I just thought there were some amazing people and some bright young minds, and it was lovely. It was a privilege to be there.
Yeah, I love that. We went and did a download the other day on all the Slido questions that came in from the panels, and just scanning over those, because in some rooms there was like 50 questions. Like, we didn't have anywhere near enough time to answer 50 questions. But as you say, just seeing the curiosity and realizing what opportunity we've created for these young people to be able to ask these questions that day to day at school they haven't got the opportunity, or their teachers don't know that world, so they can't answer it from a place of confidence and knowledge and experience. So yeah, it's very interesting. Very interesting. What did you take from Daryl's talk?
Yeah, I thought it was quite good. Yeah, I quite enjoyed Aspiration Digital and stuff that you were talking about. Quite familiar with you're a psychologist. You can tell people's body language and stuff like that. And I was quite interested in that. So Have you obtained any skills maybe from being a psychologist?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a behavioural scientist, technically, academically. Okay. I have a postgraduate diploma, but I'm not really a psychologist. I'm much more practical rather than academic. But yeah, lots and lots of skills. But it's interesting you point out body language, because that is the one thing that, you know, I would urge people to pay more attention to. And I don't mean, you know, like, buy a book and decode every little movement and give it a meaning or whatever, but it's just looking for the broader things. You know, are people, you know, relaxed and in sync? Are people in sync with everyone else, or are they out of sync? You know, like, people walking together will match each other's pace. And if they're not matching each other's pace, there's a bit of, they're not connected, they're not in sync. Or, you know, people sitting in more or less the same way. When they say, yes, I'll do that, are they nodding their head or are they shaking their head? And it can be that obvious. It can be, you know, can you do that by tomorrow? Yeah, of course, they'll say, you know, with their head shaking. Or, you know, or they'll say no and nod, you know, catch people out for not telling you the truth sometimes. So it's not about, like, necessarily learning every finer tuned thing, but just being more aware of it, because it kind of allows you to be, again, more in the moment and less in your own mind, just thinking about what you're going to say next. You know, you're seeing the response to what's actually happening when you communicate.
What's been the impact, do you think? Because we, especially over the career you've had, we've gone from a time where we would have all been in offices all together all the time as a team. You talked about your tight-knit team of 11 and you all knew each other really well. Obviously, we now live in a world where people aren't always together, and sometimes they haven't even met their team and we're meeting through a video call, which makes body language, you just have that little square around someone to see. What's the impact on that? And how's that changed things for you, being able to read those scenarios?
Well, I have to be careful not to be, you know, an old person with, you know, obviously you can't fix tomorrow's world with nostalgia, you know, and you can't go back to how things used to be, the good old days and how things used to be. But obviously I do highly value in-person connection and in-person communication. I think it's a whole different world. There is a different amount of data you get from the interaction. You know, it's a different amount of information interpersonally coming across than there is, you know, when you're on a screen, and a lot of that's reduced. You know, people on mute, sometimes they're not even, you can't even see them. Sometimes you just get their name on a blank screen. And so it's sort of non-communication, really. I think it's a mixed bag. I was on a call the other day, on a sort of a webinar call, and there was an HR expert, and they said, look, you know, people have changed what their priorities, and, you know, their lifestyle is really important to them. And this, you know, back to the office 9 to 5, forget it. It's not going to happen. The world has changed. It's, you know, you can work from anywhere. Get with the program, you old boomers. And then in the next breath, they said, we've got a chronic problem with a lack of role modeling of abilities, a lack of exchange, a lack of, you know, being able to see how someone else does it and drink up that experience and be able to, because we learn from observing others. We learn more from role modeling than you can ever learn from a book. You know, we learn how that person would handle that scenario because you see them pick up the phone. You hear their voice tone.
Yeah.
You know, you see what else is going on in their world. And one more thing is that, you know, the most worrying trend I saw recently is that in some organizations, when people are asked, when you're faced with a problem, what do you do first? Talk to your colleague or go to GPT? they go to GPT. And it's and that's not silly, because they'll get a great answer there and it'll help them do their job. But it's just yet another breaking of the vital connection between human beings.
And it loses the cultural bit there as well, because actually that whole thing about this is how we do things around here in this business, ChatGPT is not going to give you that for your business. It's going to give you a standard answer, which, as you say, might be okay, but it's not necessarily going to help you fit in culturally. So if a young person's got the option to go and work for a massive global brand, but they're going to be working from home and they might get to travel to America once a year for a week where they get to be in the office, versus they can work for a local business where they're going to get to be in the office 5 days a week if they want to, where would you put the opportunity?
If it was my kids, just to take any kind of bias out of it, just think, you know, just purely from the intention of what's going to be best for them in their life and their development, I would always, always, always tell them to go and work in the small business.
Yeah.
Especially in the early part of their career. I'm not sure that works later. I mean, you know, big businesses are can be a really cozy ride.
Yeah.
Or at least they have been in the past. I'm not sure if the future looks like that. But the thing about being in a smaller business is you see everything. You see, you operationally get a lens on everything, your internal and external operating environment. You understand how everything works. You can see all the bits that are needed. You can see when the business goes off balance and you haven't got enough of whatever you need to do stuff over here. Or you get a very hands-on experience of the living, breathing reality of what an organization really is. And then as organizations get bigger and bigger and bigger, you become more and more siloed, more and more specialist, more and more sort of shut away. And there are a lot of people in big organizations that, you know, busily sharing presentations and going on Zoom calls and chatting on Slack. But if you ask them, what is the impact of what you do? You know, what difference does this make? What's a win? They don't even know. You know, their criteria is, I have to do what I'm asked to do by my line manager and do it well. There's no visibility of, well, what does that mean? You know, why are you even doing it?
Yeah.
And I think, you know, people who go straight into big organizations on grad programs or whatever, through no fault of their own, can end up becoming mindless process followers. Because they just don't have the opportunity or the data or the insight to think more broadly, because they're in a silo from day one.
Mm. Yeah, 100%. I agree with that a lot, because I think when you're working underneath someone, you're just given rules, do this, do that. But when you're in more of like a smaller business, you learn more things. You learn about how people who are higher up than you, how they do things, and then you can progress more and grow more.
Yeah.
Absolutely right.
It's that osmosis, isn't it? It's where... because every learning opportunity isn't, I'm going to sit down and teach you something, Daryl. It's just that, as you say, seeing what happens, and you don't even know you've seen it necessarily. You don't stop afterwards and go, oh, I just learned something there. I really like the way Daryl did that. It's just gone in. It's just, and it builds and it builds and it builds, and you just don't realize you're learning it. And one day you find yourself doing what Daryl did and you're like, oh, okay, that's interesting. I knew how to handle that. And you don't really know necessarily where it's come from, but it's just, it builds. Whereas if you're on your own, on a Zoom call all day, that's the only way. It's very limited, isn't it? That view of the world to know. So I was listening to the podcast Nudge the other day, which is amazing for like learning about behavioral science and nudges, etc. And they were talking about memory and actually how the less we do, the more that affects our ability to remember. So, and they were talking about the fact that if you work from home a lot, and specifically looking at some of the research that was done around COVID, where we just were stuck indoors and stuck with the same pattern, it actually affects our ability to remember things. What are your thoughts on that?
100%. I mean, our memory or our faculties are spatial, you know, and they're images. You know, we the markers for our life are the experiences that we're having and the places we're going, and that's what makes the narrative of our life. And it's the images in the back of your mind that are the most important to pay attention to. Even though sort of in academia and that, you know, unconscious imagery is kind of ignored. They just sort of look at thoughts and feelings and don't pay so much attention to what's really going on in your mind. But London cab drivers have this phenomenon where when they do the knowledge and they learn all the streets in London and they drive around all of them for a couple of years, learning every little shortcut and every road change, their hippocampus grows. It gets bigger. So there's an area of their brain that physically grows to accommodate the knowledge. And they tend to have fantastic memories. And it's because we for anything we remember, we put a marker against it in our mind, and that marker is experiential. It's a place, it's a space, it's a face, it's an image. And if we don't have enough variety of images, we've got nothing to mark things against, which is why, you know, if a song came out during lockdown, you can't remember when in during lockdown that song came out or what order things happened in, because it was just so much routine.
So
routine makes days seem long at the time because they're boring, but when you look back, they've gone at lightning speed because there was not enough novelty to make it furnish your mind with experience.
So interesting, isn't it? So I guess actually thinking, because you've probably got some exams coming up, is there anything around like remembering things for exams that might be an interesting tip for our audience?
Yeah, precisely this. So make a memory palace, make a place to remember things in. So first time, so when I lived in America, I used to come home frequently, and because I flew all the time, you know, it's terrible to say now, it's like flight shaming because, you know, environmentally, I'm sure it's terrible, but I was on an airplane every 2-3 days for 2 years, you know, and I would fly to all over the US to stitch together deals, you know, that I was working on. And, but then every sort of 3 months or whatever, 3 to 6 months, I jump on a plane and come back to the UK, and I arrive at the airport and I give them a ticket and they would say passport. And I would look at them blankly and then go, oh, and have to run out to my car and drive home and get my passport, because I was so used to flying without a passport that I didn't associate going to the airport with needing a passport anymore. And my friend Dave at the time said to me, okay, sit down and get the image that you think of when you think of airplanes in the airport. And I went there and sat down, and an image came to my mind, which was an image looking out over Gatwick Airport. And he said, right, now replace the tailplane, the fin at the back, of every airplane with your passport. And I made this picture in my mind of every plane having my passport as the sort of fin at the back of the plane, the tailplane. And I never forgot my passport again, because I had a visual experience that was a memory cue, rather than trying to remember it in words and think it, which is, you know, a really bad strategy. So when you want to remember things, make them novel and make them visual. And if you've got a lot of things to remember or a sequence of things to remember, build yourself a memory palace. And the easiest way to do that is walk yourself through your daily routine. You know, I wake up, I turn to my phone or whatever, and I look at my phone. Then I get up and I have a drink of water and I go to the bathroom, and then I interact with the bathroom, whatever, brush my teeth, whatever it is I do. I go downstairs, I get a bowl from the cupboard. So find all of those things that you do with as part of that daily routine, and then take the things you need to remember and pop them into all of those experiences. So when I wake up, I look at my phone, and on my phone, I see whatever the first thing you need to remember is. Then I sit up and I pick up the glass and to have my drink, and I notice in the glass is the second thing that you need to remember. Then I get up and I go to the bathroom, and et cetera. So you take your lived experience, things that you know really, really well, your natural unconscious imagery, which is different to thinking of pictures, like use the pictures that are already there, that are embedded, and then add novel visual qualities to them, and you will never forget.
Wow.
Wow, that was really interesting that you say that.
Are you going to be doing that?
Yeah, maybe actually for my exams.
I love that.
Even just to remind me to just start revising, I could just be putting down a marker in my mind.
Yeah. Or a familiar journey. Like if you've walked the same way to college every day, put things on all the street signs and the, you know, add things to the experience that you already synonymously have in the back of your mind.
That is gold dust, isn't it? Yeah, it's gold dust. I love that. Any final questions for Daryl? Because we could sit here forever, I do
we
believe.
We could talk forever.
Yeah, probably. One thing that I kind of want to go into detail is, what about your book? You've talked a lot about your books, so can you go into a little bit of detail, maybe any unreleased books or stuff like that?
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. Oh, that's an emotionally turmoil. So I wrote my first book in 2006, and I wrote a manual for a training course, and I thought, well, if I just put an intro and a conclusion, then it's sort of like a book, you know, like a business book. That wasn't great. I wasn't that proud of it, but it was helpful. It was a helpful book. And I picked up a copy of the Writers and Artists Yearbook, which is published every year and you can get it in W.H. Smith or whatever. And I leafed through it and I found this small publisher called Business Books 2000. And this, it was 2006. So they probably weren't the most, you know, on it and from a brand point of view, publisher you could find. But really credible, loads and loads of authors, and they've been doing it for many years, based in Cambridge. And I gave them a call and I said, will you publish my book? And they said, oh, we doubt it. But, you know, why not send it over? So I sent them the manuscript and they came back the next day and said, yeah, great, let's do a deal. And they sent over a contract within the week and I published my book. Super duper. And I thought that's how publishing worked. Silly me. And then I published a couple more books. I published one on how to have performance conversations. There was a very niche little book. And I published one with an Olympic medalist on how to be a mentor. And I did a kid's book as well. And I did them again with tiny little publishing, whatever. Anyway, 2008, I've decided that all the books I've published, or 2010 probably, I've decided all the books that I published weren't, you know, really meaningful enough. They were kind of good, but they were a bit trivial. You know, they were just for specific things. So I sat down to write the book, you know, like the book I would write for my kids. You know, the here's all of my unusual thinking. Here's how, you know, all the hours and hours I've spent of experimentation and 10,000 hours of working with real people on real problems. And so I put this all into this book and I spent 10 years writing it. And I finished it, I'm going to say about 4 years ago, and I still haven't got it published. And I'm looking for a publisher who can take this book on, and I cannot find one. And what I've learned is that about the world of publishing, well, one is that mainly they're interested in how big your platform is, sadly, rather than what you've actually written. But publishers will tell you they want new ideas. And what they really want is new spins on existing ideas. And if you have a genuinely new way of seeing something or a genuinely new narrative, good luck, because people don't know what box to put it in. They don't know what to do with it. So I'm in this weird world where I share my book with people, with like industry peers, thought leaders, experts, and they'll come back and say, oh my goodness, this is like one of the best nonfiction books I've ever read in my life. Can I get it published? Not at the moment.
I've read it and it's amazing. And also knowing you, you seep out the pages of it, which is amazing because, yeah, you've got an infectious love for what you do and that comes out of the pages. You mentioned, obviously, you wrote a book with an Olympic medalist.
Yes.
I always think it's quite interesting and I think it was probably from you that I learned actually how much we can learn about performance from looking at sports professionals. And I suppose, like, I feel like you've done quite a lot of work in that space before. Are there any kind of tips on that? Because in the world of business, we're like, oh, what can we learn about that from sport? But actually there is so much in the discipline that it takes to grow your craft, etc.
Yeah. And it's discipline is the thing, I think. So when you work with Olympic or people who perform, I'm lucky enough to have a few friends who are medalists, and they're quite unusual, you know, and their level of clarity and discipline is off the charts. And I think there's so much you can learn from them. And there's also this, the reality that they live in a slightly clearer world because they know what all the milestones are. You know, they know when the Olympic Games is or when the World Championship is, and they know what their speed is, and they know what they need to do for their nutrition, and they know what, and they have a training plan, and they have, so everything's very, very linear in their world, you know. I mean, not taking anything away from it, it's absolutely mind-blowing and incredible what they achieve, but they don't sit there going, should I be a diver? You know, is this the right career path for me, running around in circles? You know, that level of, like, unquestioned clarity is what allows them to have that level of discipline. And I think you can learn so much about from them in terms of how to perform, you know, and it is about consistency and it is about discipline and it is about paying attention to where you are right now and not worrying about the outcome because that's 18 months away and dealing with today. And there's so many, how to visualize. Like, I've got one of my friends, Sally Gunnell, is the master of visualization. And she, when she, I'm good at it, but when she talks about visualization, it's enthralling.
And what do you mean by visualization? Because some of our audience, obviously, we can all imagine visualizing, but why? Why would you visualize?
Ah, okay. So it's making memories of the future. So creating images in your mind of whatever behavior you want to adopt or whatever outcome you want to achieve. A bit like manifesting. But there's certain rules to it in order to do it with absolute precision. Like, for example, if you're trying to manifest a performance, make sure that you see yourself from the outside when you're visualizing it, because that's what teaches you unconsciously to that dissociated view kind of teaches your behavior. And if you're manifesting a celebration or a wonderful emotional experience, make sure you're seeing it through your eyes and you're in the moment, because that's what ups the ante in terms of your biochemical reaction. So there's like precision to visualization, but I've never, ever, ever. Is that true? Can I think of an example? Yeah, absolutely true. I've never, ever met an elite performer in any field who doesn't visualize.
Mm. I did it for Aspiration Digital last week. Like, I'd spent a lot of time just thinking and being in it, but also being watching it.
Yeah.
And it does, and I learned that from you, it really helps, because then on the day it doesn't feel new. You're like, I've been here before. Yeah. I know what's going to happen. I'm going to be celebrating at the end of this. And I know what that's going to feel like, which is an amazing feeling and makes it more likely to happen, doesn't it?
Yes. Yeah. It's almost like the powerful part of your mind knows what the plan is.
Yeah.
Rather than the sort of cognitively straining, having to think type part of your mind, which actually is a low performance state. You know, when we think really hard, we frown. If I say to you, what's 2 + 2? You'd say 4. If I say, what's 127 minus 3, then you have to go into this kind of like really focused, shut the world away type state of mind. And it's a low performance state. We tend to think that, you know, thinking really hard is how to use our mind, because that's what we're taught, right? It's called sit still, concentrate, focus, try harder. But our life experience is that every eureka moment, every creative idea, every time you've suddenly gone, ah, of course, I know the answer. You've been in the shower or on a train or playing sport, or, you know, it's when you are awake and you're in the world and you're aware of your body and what's going on outside of you and you're engaged in a task like playing Lego or something, you know. It's when we're in those moments of mental engagement, like general mental engagement, that all the eureka moments happen. And when we go into laser focus and we frown and, you know, hold our head really still and concentrate, that's quite good for complex maths or Sudoku, but for everything else it's terrible, because we're actually using less of our intelligence. We're funneling everything just through our rational linguistic mind, and it makes us dafter, which is counter to absolutely everything you're taught from the academically biased education system that you've just come through.
Mm. It's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, that is quite interesting.
Oh, we literally could talk forever, but I feel like we should let you get on with your day.
Have we run out of time?
I feel like we probably have, but I mean, it's been amazing, hasn't it?
Yeah, it really has.
Really good. Like, thank you.
Well, great questions. I feel
like we've learned so much, not just about your career and how to get started in a business, etc., but also we've gone, as I hope we would, into some of the psychology and things. And we got some great revision tips as well, haven't we? Which is amazing. So thank you so much, Daryl. Thank you, Elliot. You've been amazing.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Elliot. Great questions. Yeah,
really good. And we look forward to seeing you on a future episode of Behind the Future. Thank you.
Chin chin.
That concludes another brilliant episode of Behind the Future. Thank you so much for listening. You can listen back to other episodes on YouTube or your podcast platform of choice. Make sure you hit the subscribe button, as that will help us to grow this podcast, ensuring we can get the best guests on here for you to learn from. You can also follow us on socials, linked in the show notes for exclusive content. See you on the next episode.